The situation that we find in chapter 17 is about 12 to 14 miles from Bethlehem, and the man Goliath has been making quite an impression upon all who are able to look at him. And as you look at the passage here, there is a line-on-line description of his size, of his armor, and of the weaponry that he was able to put his hand to. And they show him, indeed, to be a very formidable foe. He was approximately 9 foot 6 inches tall, wearing approximately 125 pounds of armor, and the point or the head of a spear is estimated at 15 pounds weight. These are very serious things for any challenger to consider. Now, he calls for a challenger. And it seems that day after day, Saul, who was the leader at that time of Israel, and the people themselves are both impressed by what Goliath says and what he seems to be, but they're also depressed as they consider the great might that he seems to have. Now, I just want to say at this time, I don't know where Jonathan was. And not very long ago, Jonathan had displayed tremendous courage and was a man who went out and engaged in the Lord's battle, and he was fearless. There's not much sign of him just at the moment as they gather here in the valley of Elah. And then young David arrives here on the scene. And while in chapters 13 and 14 of this book, Jonathan seemed, now he wasn't the only believer there, but he seemed to be at times the only believer in Israel. Now David fulfills that role. And you can picture the scene there, brethren and sisters. You have on one side of the valley, Goliath. He's mocking. He's arrogant. And on the other side of the valley, you have the forces of Saul. They are in trepidation, and they're completely bewildered. It says there in verse 11, I think it is, when Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. The words mean to be petrified. Very often when, and there's no nice wars, by the way, but when men are getting ready to engage in battle, they get themselves, you could use the word psyched up, stirred up. Sometimes in American history, they've quoted great things from their own past, such as remember the Alamo. And they've got their minds, their mental preparation done in order to be able to go and engage the enemy. Apart from that, they wouldn't be able to do it. And here are men who are, they're completely in dismay. That's what the Bible says. They're beside themselves with fear. But as Goliath mocks and rants, he does it once too often. And David hears him. And when David comes, he seems to be, and I'm impressed with him right away when I see him here, he seems to be at a loss to understand why no one is taking up this challenge. Remember Saul, he was a big, tall man. There were other men there who were quite tall and strong as well. Not as tall as Goliath, we'll admit, but men who should have been leading there in that battle. And what follows in Operation Elah, folks, we see God's providence. We see his preparing of the instrument. But especially, there is great faith on the part of David. He's just a young fella, but he displays in this valley tremendous faith. You can take the units of men all along the side of the valley, but no one daring to cross the stream to rush the enemy and to lock battle for the Lord. And folks, we often remind ourselves that we're not in a unique situation, because if you seek to do anything for the Lord, you will be locking battle with the enemy. And more than that, you will need faith. I was reading somewhere in a book this week that when all is rosy and good, displaying faith in God's promises and in his word and in his person, it's the easiest thing in the world, because there aren't any real difficulties. But whenever your back is to the wall, as it was here in this situation, then your faith will be put to the test. You see, so often today, as it was with Saul and the men of Israel in those days, the vehicle used to intimidate us, to frighten us, to discourage us, to just knock the heart out of us, is what we see. It's what we see. There were many other people with Goliath, but I would say every eye in Israel was on him, because he was their champion at that time. There was huge opposition, and there's huge opposition today, folks, and the devil will go the second mile to silence you and to have you not use your gifts and to have you take your talents, as it were, and just hide them in the ground and shatter your confidence. That's what he will do. And when he comes to do that to you and to me, that is when really faith comes in. And there is that leaning on the Lord alone. Picture the situation here. David was the last man that anyone would have chosen, and we're going to see that in a minute. But he was the man. And as we look at Operation Elah today, I want you to notice here, first of all, the vision of faith. The vision of faith. If you look at verse 10 there, and also in verse 25, you will see here that the giant himself openly admits, and it is admitted by others as well, that he is defying them. He doesn't make any bones about it. The challenge is there. And in verse 25 it says, "And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel has he come up. And it shall be that the man who killeth him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." Where it says his father's house free, there's very interesting, and it might appeal to us sometimes. It means really tax exemption. And you'd have thought that would have appealed to some. Of course it didn't. They were too scared at that time. But only David seems concerned enough to do anything, because he refers to this man as an uncircumcised Philistine. He's starting now. I wouldn't say he's being abusive here, but he's heading back. He's not painting a picture of someone who is massive and cannot be tackled, but rather he's seeking to even encourage the men around him to realize that this person, who does he think he is? Especially at the end of that verse 26. Defy the armies of the living God. That is where David's confidence lay. Now, nothing had happened yet down here in the valley, but only David seems concerned enough to actually do anything. And he asserts this point, if you look at verse 36 and verse 45 and so on, you can take time yourself. It says there, "And thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them." Not because there's anything special about David, but seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. And again in verse 45, "Then said David to the Philistine, thou comest to me with sword and with spear and with shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast defied." Folks, you cannot read these verses and think otherwise than that David took it very personally, that God was being defied. He took it very personally, and he had a vision here of faith. The driving concern of the whole chapter is not that David might be seen to be anyone special, but that God's honor and God's name and God's reputation and God's glory might be upheld. The focus of chapter 17, therefore, is not David's courage, but it's God's adequacy for David. It's God enabling him. You can read verse 37, 45, and 47 yourself. David here will in a most dramatic way, take what humanly speaking is a step of courage. But he does so because God's honor is at stake. This was something that was to mark him for most of the rest of his life. We knew he fell. And he fell into sin and grieved the Lord. But God's honor at this time meant a great deal to David, so much so that it took him out of his comfort zone. He wasn't even initially at the front line with Saul and with his brother Eliab, with David's brother Eliab and so on. He was still out with the sheep. Again, counted as not really worthy to be there by some. But he was well out of his comfort zone now, and it was honor. It was concern for God's honor that took him out of that comfort zone. Remember earlier what we said, that the vehicle is often what we see. David wasn't bothered. He wasn't bothered. And folks, I asked myself today, how is my vision? I asked myself concerning especially those who are coming after, boys and girls, growing up in a corrupt world, a world that is quickly ripening for the judgment of God. Have I enough concern in order to bring myself out of my comfort zone, as David did, and say, well, I'm not going to sit back. I'm not going to watch this defying of the Lord's cause, but I'm going to do something. You know, we have a Consider Christ campaign. 70 or 80 people go down every now and again across the border. Way down there and work hard, giving our tracts, engaging people in conversation, then follow-up meetings and so on. And you know, on a human level, there's very little thanks for it. You know, a lot of people will even forget that you go to do it. And people do not go there, and I want to make it very clear that we do not go there, our church does not go there, in order that we might be able to say, well, the Free Presbyterian Church is reaching into the south. There are a good number of other people down there reaching out as well, and from here reaching down there as well. But we are where the Lord has placed us. And people are willing to, and I've been a couple of times just, I wish it was there more, and I may get this year sometimes, but you look around and you see all these people who have families and young students who usually work on a Saturday to get some money. And they've given it up. They've given it up to go because they have a vision of what God can do. They're very aware of the great darkness that there is there. And what I'm saying is they put themselves out in order to stand up for Jesus and to defend his cause and to contend for the faith by promoting the gospel across the border there down in the Republic of Ireland. If you look with me there in what it says over in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 33, this chapter has given us details regarding people who were acted in faith. They were in very difficult situations many times. But it says in verse 33, this is really covering them, it says, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, and stopped the mouths of lions. Now, none of those situations were straightforward. They weren't straightforward. But you know what they saw? They were just like David. What they saw did not cow them. It didn't have them shrink away and run away. And folks, the whole world, it seems, in 2017... defies God and mocks his name. Defies God and mocks his name. And there are many things, and my boys, some of them are grown up into men now. And there are many things that I'll not be able to give them as far as this world is concerned. But I would want them to see me as one who cares. One who is faithful. One who is willing to honor the Lord for the sake of those who come after. Choice faces every one of us. We honor the Lord by confronting the giants of today. And that doesn't mean, as we'll notice, just talking about it. It means doing something. Or we can go with the spirit of the age. Remember, on one side of that valley today, if we were in the Valley of Elah, we have our forefathers standing there and wishing to contend for the cause of Christ. Our forefathers would have gone. They would have crossed the river. And as we study even and remember in this Reformation year, all that God has done so much since then. In the revivals in England, and even in the revival here as well. And folks, the tide of iniquity has come in like a flood. There's liberalism, there's a fit-in culture. All of this is coming against the Christian church. And it seems to be having good success. And really, can we stand back and watch the world defy and deride and mock God's word and God's name and God's day and the gospel of Christ and not have a burning desire to go forth in faith? The book of Jude. We're to earnestly contend for the faith once delivered to the saints. And the question I ask myself, I don't ask it to any of the rest of you, you must do that for yourself. Have I this vision of faith that David had? Look at what he said there whenever he was talking about this man. He spoke of him in a most disparaging way. He called him an uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God. In other words, who does this man think he is? And why are you not doing anything about it? Why are you not engaging him? I asked myself, have I that vision of faith to consider doing what I can for the Lord? To have that vision that things must not go on as they are. Remember Moses there? He was well learned in all the best education that was available in Egypt. He was extremely well trained military, in a military fashion. It says there in Hebrews 11 concerning him, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. Now, not many will do that. The word esteeming means to lead something before your mind, to evaluate it. He weighed it all up. He had everything. He had everything in Egypt. But he thought the reproach of Christ, that is, being in a similar situation to David, he thought that was better. Because it says there that he esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt. But at the very start of that verse 24, it says, by faith, Moses. By faith he did it. When he went out of Egypt, he didn't know exactly what was going to happen. But he had that vision of faith, and he valued God's name and God's cause above anything else. And folks, that is what we've been called to do today. That vision of faith. But there's not only the vision of faith here, there is this solitary voice of faith. If you look there in verse 26 again, please, you will see the words that David said. He's asking, why has no one went out to fight with Goliath? Something very amazing here, and I'm sure you've noted this. This is the first time we hear David talking, actually. Do you remember way back? In the last chapter, he didn't say anything. Some of his brothers had plenty to say, but he didn't say anything. And this is the first time we hear him talk. Obviously, David could talk, but up until now, literally, he's been mute. Hasn't said anything. But some people say that when you look at verse 26, what he says here is theologically loaded. It is loaded. Because here is the voice of a man who is greatly stirred. We today speak about adrenaline. You know about different athletes and adrenaline and so on, and how it works and all. What you could say concerning him, that here is a man who had an adrenaline rush in the best possible way. The Lord had stirred his heart. Now, he looked all around him, he could have been disappointed. But he was determined that things would change if God would use him. Now, the quote of David's words here in verse 26, they were really listening to someone who was saying, you know, are you men afraid? Why have you not raised your voice? Why has nobody come out and stood here for the Lord? He's trying, I believe, in verse 26 to instill confidence or faith, to instill faith in the men who are around him. And yet he was alone. He was there alone. And you know, sometimes Christians, when they seek to do what they can, wherever it is, in whatever area of the work, not this is not confined to preaching or missionary work, but whenever God's work you're in, you can feel alone after disappointment. Remember Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 19? He ran away into the desert and he said, I am left. He repeated the words. There's only him left. See, discouragement or disappointment can get you to look inward and start thinking negative things. And when your head is filled with negative things and you see nothing but giants out there, you're not going to raise your voice in faith. You're not going to do it. And Elijah was out there a broken man, a shadow of what he had formerly been. But the Lord hadn't forgotten him. We know that the Lord came along and encouraged him and sent him on his way again. And by the way, he wasn't alone, and neither are you. There were 7,000 that hadn't bowed the knee to Baal, and there are still people today all over the place that are seeking to serve the Lord with all of their hearts. I'm speaking to a man from down the country. Actually, I was trying to get Grace McClintock to come back and sing. She was here a few months ago. You know, she attends Independent Methodist Church in Irvinstown. And I was speaking to her husband, and he was telling me they had a mission there in a little hut in Trillick. Now, if you know where Trillick is, if you blink, you've missed it. Very small. They had a mission there in a little hut, and certainly not a built-up area, but over the period of the mission, so far there have been 10 people come to Christ. 10 have come to the Lord. There was one woman who was walking along there, he told me, just one day after the mission. She's coming along, she was half drunk, and she stopped to speak with a man who was preaching, and she just said, you know, my partner died X number of weeks ago, and I've hit the bottle ever since. And he made an arrangement to come and see her, and then she had to go into hospital, so he went into hospital to see her, and there he led her to the Lord. Now, out in a place like Trillick, I have to say that that was a venture of faith, putting up a hut and arranging a mission. I think it went for 9 weeks, that mission. So maybe it was 7 weeks. But so easy when you're disappointed to feel that you're on your own. But just like them people, I can't remember the young fellow's first name, but the whole lot of them just going forward in faith. Willing to step out and say, well, there's darkness all around us. That was some of the words that young fellow used. He says, you know, he says, there's really tremendous need right on our doorstep. So there is. Tremendous need. Tremendous need for what? Tremendous need for the voice of faith. For someone to say, we're not going to sit back and just watch our fellow man and fellow woman live and die without Christ. We're not going to sit back and watch the cults and apostasy grow. We're going to do something. We're actually going to do something about it. But David here was on his own. It's always harder than when you feel that you're on your own. Do you remember Paul when he was writing to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 16? He said, at my first call, no man stood with me. He could have run away. Then he went on to say, but the Lord stood with me and strengthened me. And that made all of the difference. Both Paul and Elijah that I have already mentioned here, they had to keep their focus on the Lord, and so do you and I. We need to keep our focus on the Lord. And maybe your voice, we're speaking here at the solitary voice of faith, maybe your voice is a lonely one, and I want to encourage you that God is on your side. He's on your side. And this solitary voice, you can almost feel the hush of the men around him. As some of them undoubtedly thinking, who does he think he is? Look at him. He's just in from the field there. But he was a man of faith. And folks, you and I are nothing special. But read Hebrews 11 then, read it again. And encourage your own soul of what the Lord is able to do now in our day, and to do with us. So there was here this solitary voice of faith. There was, first of all, the vision of faith. But then there is, thirdly here, the interrogation of faith. If you look at verse 28, right through to verse 29, you will see that we have Eliab here. Eliab in verse 28, he's the eldest brother. And here, in a most outstanding and remarkable way, he lets the whole family down. Because he's what you would call, he's an armchair theologian. He knows all about it, knows how it should be done, and not a bit afraid to tell David how he can't do it. You see that David here has taken a stand. Maybe some people are saying, well, what's this young, maybe this young fellow has a point. Maybe we should engage him. But Eliab, he steps up and he says, you know, it says here that his anger was kindled against David. And he says, why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast I left those few sheep in the wilderness? That's a dig again. David, you're just a shepherd. That's all you can do. You're not qualified for this kind of situation. And he rubs it in a bit more at the end of the verse. He says, you're come down that you mightest see the battle. Eliab's pouring cold water upon it. As I said, he's doing absolutely nothing except his tongue drips with contempt. And David now is discouraged by someone who should have encouraged him. Eliab's doing nothing. Well, he knows how to do it. He's quite happy to tell David how he should do it. Eliab is older. Remember, he was a tall man. Some people say that Eliab was like a mirror of Saul. And that is why Samuel initially thought, whenever he came in, he was the first of Jesse's sons to come in. Samuel hadn't learned the lesson of going for appearance, and he thought, this is him. But it wasn't him. Eliab wasn't happy with that. You see, David was chosen, and he wasn't. And he hadn't forgotten that. And now Eliab, we have Eliab here, he's stuck fast. And David here, perhaps not knowing really what to do, he just turns in verse 29 and he says, what have I now done? In other words, what's wrong now, brother? What have I done wrong? Are you upset? What have I done wrong? Is there not a cause? He seeks to direct the attention of Eliab and the others, not to him. Not even to what Eliab has said, but to the cause. That was it. Is there not a cause? And Christian, the devil will have often someone to tell you that you cannot serve the Lord. That you cannot serve the Lord. To pour cold water upon your plans. Something that might laugh. And discourage you greatly in that way. But the most important thing to remember just at this point is, David made it very, very clear that he was available. He was available. He's being interrogated by his own brother. And folks, it is a sad day if you go out to try and do something for the Lord and you meet with a Christian and they tell you, well, you're just wasting your time. You're not wasting your time. But nonetheless, whenever you're tackled in a way that David was by Eliab, again, it can knock the heart out of you. But Saul, he backs Eliab up. If you look at verse 33, it says there, and Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth. I wish I was a youth. Young people, you can do far more than us older ones. Don't listen to those words of Saul. Thou art but a youth, and a man of war. He is a man of war. From his youth. Those were encouraging words. Definitely not. I want you to turn you to a verse, folks, to encourage you at this time. No matter about the Eliabs or the Sauls of this world. Look at what it says over there in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. It says there in verse 4. Verse 3 says, For if we walk in the flesh, we do war after the flesh, or according to the flesh. But the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations, and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. The thought there where it says, mighty through God, is of spiritual empowerment. That's what David was going to have. In other words, you could say that David had at least three giants to confront before he got to the giant. He had the giant of self. Self-minded whispers in his ear. It's lovely out here in the meadow, the sheep. Quite tranquil. There's no noise of war here. What a lovely place to be. Flesh always tells us something like that. Take it easy. Somebody else will do it. So he had the giant of self to face. And then he had the giant of scoffing to face. That was his brother Eliab. Then he had the giant of Saul to face. He was the king. And he had to face all of these before he actually got to confront the giant himself. It seems that the odds are all against him. And folks, will not lie to you. It seems today that the odds are all against Christian. People, most people who do most things for the Lord are ordinary people. Ordinary people. Serving him here, there and yonder. I think I did tell you last week about the girl who was just jogging down the pathway and stopped. Could come back and said to her family, I just want to talk to you about the Lord. Not in an argument, but a very friendly, nice way. And then just run on again. Ordinary people doing the Lord's bidding. And folks, we are very small in this world, but we should encourage each other to do all that we can. Encourage each other to be not like Eliab and like Saul, just sitting there knowing what should be done, but actually do it. And if our heart is stirred, the heart of others will be stirred too. That's what happens when revival comes. Remember the four rustics up in Kells and Connor? That's what they called them, four rustics. They were very ordinary fellows. Gathered for prayer and then others joined them. Before too long, other people were stirred to pray as well. That's why he was really pleased with Wednesday night. Now, it mightn't happen again. I hope it does. But there's such an attendance. Even last Sunday morning, 13 in the prayer meeting on Sunday morning was really, really encouraging. And if we can catch fire, that's the word I'm really looking for. If we can catch the fire, it can spread to others. We will benefit, our families will benefit, the community around us will benefit, and we can confront the giants together. We can confront the giants together. And there are Christians today, and they're at a crossroads. They can go on and go through with God, or they can pull back and content themselves just sitting on the side of the valley. I'd rather be with David, weak and all as I am, an awful lot weaker than he was. But I just want to say that, in closing, that again in Northern Ireland, apathy is a plight in the UK, and you will meet, or you may meet, with Christians out there and who do not believe, really, in bothering with evangelism and who have no real zeal to really get stuck into what they're doing. And that can discourage you. But we must keep looking to the Lord and look for that victory even over fear. It's not a psychological trick to get victory over fear. But it's looking to the Lord and leaning upon him. Now, the next time when we come back, and we're going to continue on because a new time had run out, I'm going to look at this passage again and look at faith delivering. Faith delivering. I trust I've said enough to have you interested in it and say, Lord, well, I am just feeling my own weakness. But I see here that it's nothing new. And that the Lord is able to use me if I'm available for him. We'll look at that the next time faith delivers. Now, I was going to